the moment that we have all been waiting for. I have the questions in this lovely hat, and we will be pulling them out one by one, alternating who of our two ministers answers first. I will read out the question. Well, I'll read out the name. Raise your hand so I can make sure you're here, because remember, if you're not here or there's no name, you can't win. And if they're getting a little too wordy, let me know. I'll ring the bell.
You ready? All right.
Yes.
From Shelley Barnard. All right.
Present. Presente.
All right, it says for AJ and Lydia both, but especially AJ as a younger guy.
Excellent, you get to start.
Briefly, what are your thoughts about video games, smartphones, and the general pervasiveness of electronic devices in the lives of kids? Anything supportive to say to parents of fifth grade boys and others? Thank you.
Oh, I have an answer for that too. Good.
Well, let's see. Two things come to mind. One is that I myself spent a significant time in my childhood playing video games, and look where I am now. So it's not, you know. The other thing I would say is that I would defer to, scientists and studies who've looked at things about screen time. I'm not up on all of that myself. I know there's some effects and some good practices on limiting the time and doing that kind of thing. But I also think it's... It also depends on, you know, what it is that they're doing and even what kinds of games that they're playing. I enjoy video games. Not all video games are created equal. Some are more stimulating, engaging, might help with creative thinking and creative problem solving. Other video games, especially like on your phone, it's just sort of mindless tapping and not doing a whole lot. So there's a question about what the games are and if it's computer time. You know, the internet and social media have a lot of dangers and pitfalls, but there's also a lot to be said for the connectivity that it brings. And so just because the new generations interact and have their social networks, we've always had social networks, we just have them digitally now. Just because those look different than they did even 5 or 10 years ago, but certainly 20 or 50 years ago, doesn't mean that it's all cause for doom and gloom. But that's sort of my initial thoughts on that.
All right, so I like this question. I have a 7th grader and a high school and an 11th grader. So the first thing is I always go back to my memory of my parents saying, you're on the phone too much, right? And so each generation is going to add a new thing that parents might think is excessive. But we are also seeing that the ways that we are interacting are really shifting, right? From even way before our generations, when people used to just walk up to each other's porches and knock on their doors all the time. Now that would be extremely intrusive. And so we're watching connectedness through face-to-face get more and more limited. Now phone calls can even feel intrusive to people. We text instead. I want to agree with AJ about content. So it's like candy, right? It's like, what's the right amount? We all need time to just have fallow time and downtime, and so content feels super important to me around that. And I think, like everything, there's going to be pluses and minuses. I have heard that teen pregnancy is down as well as teenage drinking because people are not interacting together to do those things. So, but that's a positive, right? That's a real positive. So, maybe the whole birth rate is going to go down over time, which also could have some real positives, right? So someone in my family FaceTimed their friend through New Year's tonight, this year, and was a completely satisfying experience for them. It's not something I can, like, fathom, right? And I also heard, and someone in this congregation was there, and she's not here right now, of parties where everybody gets earbuds and you can listen to different music. They have 3 or 4 different kinds of music and you can go and listen to it. So my concern about that is losing shared interpersonal, real interpersonal experiences and a move towards a culture of individualism. where it's like, I get to do my thing kind of plugged in. And there's also real benefits for that, from that. So that's about what I can say about that. So without getting the hook. Pick a white one so we get, there we go. Thank you.
Sylvine Farnell, are you here?
Oops. Second okay. Service. I think a lot of people who submitted questions are not here, so.
David Burrows.
David's here.
Several years ago, it became apparent that the UUA had a white racist dilemma at leadership headquarters. What measurable progress have they made since that time?
Oh, yeah. One year I told people there were 46 pages in this, and that was a bigger font. I'm down to 26 this time. So, okay. It's mine first. Mine starts with follow AJ. Because AJ said he would dive into this a little bit, and I'll tell you what else.
Yeah, so let's see. Not everyone may be aware of this white racist dilemma or what has been called sort of a white supremacy and hiring practices controversy from a few years ago. I actually had sort of a front row seat to this at the UUA. I was in seminary. I was in Boston, and so I was able to do a field education internship at the UUA. So the first thing to say is that this is not the first dilemma or controversy that we've had around racism or white supremacy or black empowerment or race relations. Basically, what happened was it all centered around the hiring of one of the regional leads. So there's five regions of the UUA. The nation is divided up into five regions. And as of 2017, and I think for a long time, all five of those, forever, those have always been white people. I think, there's been men and women, but it's all been white people. And in 2017, they were going to hire a new lead for the southern region, and then they announced it's going to be this minister, another white man. And it sort of came out from some of the organizations of UU religious professionals of color. They were like, really? Again, another white person? Isn't there more diversity? Aren't there qualified leaders? And in fact, there were, and someone who's actually on the board of UA Board of Trustees, Christina Rivera, resigned.
Yeah.
But she was in the running for this. She's a Latina woman, religious educator, and she decided to come forward and say, I was in the running for this, I was not selected, I was told that I wouldn't be a good fit for this position. And so this comes out, and there's a lot of conversation and some controversy, and the UUA president, Peter Morales, at the time, makes some statements, and then that sort of blows a lot of things up, and then he ultimately resigns. And then some other key leaders resigned. The man who was originally going to be hired for the Southern Regional Lead position decided not to take it, and so I think they're still in an interim, or I don't know if they've decided someone yet for that. So there's, you know, there's a lot of tension, and people want to be doing the right thing. And what I would say is that the issue is not that, there were some missteps in leadership and communication that led to, for instance, Peter Morales feeling like he had to resign, that he had broken trust. This is two more things I want to say quickly. One is the language that began to be used by UUs of color, religious professionals of color, is the idea of a white supremacy culture. So this is not to say that the UUA has a white racist dilemma or that it is a white supremacist organization. Certainly there is a stark difference between Unitarian Universalism and our association and the Ku Klux Klan or some other Southern Poverty Law Center hate group. But the idea is that white supremacy culture is so ingrained in all of American culture, and it's, you know, our association is no different, and we have our own history. The other thing I want to say is about that history, some of you may be aware of something called that has been called the Black Empowerment Controversy from the late 60s in our denomination, and there was a similar time, you know, 60s Civil Rights Movement. There was a promise, there was debate over whether there should be integrationist and, black and white allies working together. And there was another group of UUs of color who said, no, we need black-led spaces, we need black power, we need you guys to just give us money and resources and just trust us and take our lead. And so there was debate around that. There was a promise of money given to, I think, both of those groups, and then it had to be taken back and renegotiated because the association was having financial difficulties, but that broke a lot of trust. So that's when there were a lot of black UUs and UUs of color who actually left the denomination. And we could go back even further and further in history of times when there were black Unitarians or black Universalists who wanted to be in the ministry and lead, and you know, the best result that they got in the 19th century was basically, oh, wonderful, we're so glad you're here, let's take a collection and send you on your way and not really support you. So it's part of an ongoing thing. The last thing I want to say is actually a note of hope, which is that the reason that this is considering the context in which this sort of controversy bubbles up, which is, one, a post-2016 election context in America where these tensions are high and these issues are very important and life and death, as they have been for a long time for marginalized people of color. And in our own denomination, this sort of conversation and tension comes up, again, it came up from UU religious professionals of color coming together, supporting each other, and talking about this kind of thing, which happens because we've done work over the past decades to support UUs of color and professionals of color. If we weren't supporting them and we weren't doing anything, we wouldn't be hearing anything, and we would be like, oh, everything's great and fine, and we're, you know, liberal progressive people and we're not racist, but, you know, we wouldn't be hearing any conflict because there wouldn't be even those voices in our denomination. So when we do support those voices, sometimes they have things to say to us that we're not very comfortable with, and that's part of the journey that we need to lean into. And it's not always comfortable to talk about these issues or to address them, but it's the work we're called to do.
I'll add a few words. That this isn't just work that needs to happen in Boston at the national leadership. I want to echo what AJ was saying about that. We are steeped in a white supremacy culture. And we as Unitarian Universalists are not immune. And sometimes, because we hold different values, that gap is even more painful for people of color. Because we hold ourselves to, those of us who are white and ascribe to Unitarian Universalism, hold ourselves to an ideal that we cannot see where we are missing it, and people of color can see it, and it's deeply painful. I'm really grateful for the education this congregation has done and what is coming up. So I want to share a little bit about what's coming up a little bit. Before we do a new hire, we have a major hire coming in the congregation with a new religious educator. We are going to do some training around what we can do to prepare ourselves to have, to dismantle our white supremacy culture that we might not be able to be aware of and see, and to be more welcoming to non-white or queer staff. It's always so important to just keep that conversation alive in us. And then regionally, we've done a few things in the past. I'm part of the UU Faith Leaders for Racial Justice, and we have led book groups on the Third Reconstruction and done this IDI training about 15 or 20 people went and kind of learned this model that about understanding our intercultural competencies. And coming up this spring, we are going to do a regional book reading and showing of the movie The Hate U Give, which, if you haven't read it, I just read it. It's a very powerful book, novel, written from the perspective of a black community when a white officer shoots and kills a young black youth. And it's, you know, it's like, you know, to really get on the inside of that. And so we'll be showing that film at The Boulder showing is going to be at UU Church of Boulder in the spring, and we'll be organizing a book group with both congregations as well.
And if I may real quick jump in, because a part of David's question was, what are the specific measurable things? So I just want to point you all to a resource. Part of the UA website is about, there's a page for the Commission on Institutional Change, which is a group of leaders that were tasked after this controversy happened to among other things, do a racism audit to investigate exactly what happened with the hiring controversy, to provide resources and do theological reflection. So, Commission on Institutional Change, if you Google that in UUA, you'll find their page. They have like monthly blog posts and they have all sorts of reports. There's a lot of good information there about the work that they and the UUA are doing.
Are there any beliefs, or Scott Nelson, are there any beliefs or practices that are not UU?
Oh, I like this one.
I do too. I also like the way it's phrased because there's, well.
Do I get to start this one though?
Yeah, you can. Sorry, go ahead.
So I always refer to an article by Rebecca Parker that I use in Path to Membership Now that I can follow up and offer people. And she talks, there's this real question about people come into Unitarian Universalism with you can believe anything you want to believe. And that does, I started there. That does an incredible disservice to the history of this tradition and to people who actually died for this religious tradition. So I want to be really clear that if that's part of your framework to see if you can work yourself into another understanding of Unitarian Universalism, and I'd be glad to help you with that. So in her article about the challenge of Unitarian Universalism, Rebecca Parker talks about four different frameworks that provide a context. So she says you can believe anything you want about whether there's a deity or not a deity and what the nature of that deity is, except, here's the boundary, as a Unitarian Universalist, we don't believe that there is an all-powerful, controlling God around humanity because we believe in free will. So that's the first thing. So when you're in that camp, you wouldn't really be in the context of being Unitarian Universalist. You can believe anything you want about what happens after life and salvation, but as Unitarian Universalist, you can't believe that it's all about that other life, that we believe that salvation is possible in this life, and we have the capacity to create the beloved community here, so we're not suffering here for something better, and suffering is not connected to whatever is after us. Oh my gosh, now I have to do all four. this afterlife, free will, oh my gosh. I'm blanking, so I'll let you talk, and then maybe they'll come to me.
So, and I might have a different list than her, and that's not surprising, since we're all UUs. So, the actual, you know, so like the belief in an all-powerful God and the free will. I mean, I think free will is a very common belief in UUism, but I wouldn't necessarily say that someone who has a more deterministic, theistic faith in a God that controls history or whatever it is. That they couldn't be a UU. You know, I want our theology to be as, the theologies that are welcome in our communities to be as open as possible. So for me, what I go to more is less of those sort of cosmological questions, which is like, well, what is the universe or reality and how does it work and, you know, what's going on? And more about sort of values and issues of human dignity, right? So you do, I think you do have to believe or that, you know, first principle, inherent worth and dignity of every person. You can't believe that some people are worthier than others or some people are more or less human than others or anything like that. You know, those are, you know, those can be extreme beliefs, but that's the kind of thing that is definitely anathema to Unitarian Universalism. And sometimes your cosmological beliefs relate to those and inform those. So I'm not saying that they're totally separate. But usually for me it comes down to, the sort of strain in Unitarian Universalism where we believe, where we care, where we're more concerned and more prioritized with what we actually do in the world than what we specifically believe. So I'm, you know, whether someone is deterministic or not in their cosmology doesn't bother me as much as if they are using that determinism to, support themselves in saying, yes, let's go out and work for social justice because God is in control of everything and love will win and let's, you know, go on forever, you know, upwards. I'd be more concerned if they said, well, God's in control of everything and bad things just happen and so I'm not going to do anything. And like, that would concern me more.
And I remember the third one. I don't remember her language, but I do remember, you know, we believe that there's many paths to one's understanding of the world, and no single path is the full, it's a full truth, including Unitarian Universalism, and I really like that because we tend to have some sense of exceptionalism, like we have found the way, and we have to be really careful about that, to really be deeply respecting of other people who may have found the way that leads them also to the same sense of values and how they work in the world. So.
She is not here. I'm trying to be fair.
Paul Brindison is not here, I don't think. No. Nope.
Must be present to win. Getting some repeats.
You looking for a white one in particular?
Yeah, that's fine. All right, we're going with blue. We know you're here. Keith. Down the road, is there thought about hiring another assistant minister?
I'll take that. That's a lovely question. We are perched on being a 300-member congregation, and my expectation is that given the times that we live in, and given the vitality of this congregation, and given our plans, we're going to exceed that and go beyond that in the next few years. So the Finance Committee and the Personnel Committee are kind of looking at what is a funding strategy to have a staffing that will enable us to be robust financial picture so that we can have the staffing for another minister. So. Do you want to add anything to that?
That's on you.
That's on
you guys.
Me. That's on us, actually. Yeah. So, is that an expression of a desire?
Sure.
Okay. I certainly love working in a team, so it's super powerful for me to have a team.
Kelly Lott.
No, Kelly's not here now. So is there some correlation between getting your things in ahead of time and being a second service person? They're up late writing in their forms and they don't come to the early service.
Carol.
Hughes. Is that Carol?
Yes, Carol Hughes.
Okay.
What do you use believe happens when we die?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, you go first.
Well, of course, there's a diversity of beliefs. Each individual UU probably has a slightly different belief around that. I will say that the universalist strain in our history leads us to what is often articulated as the idea that whatever happens to us happens to all of us. So again, it's this equality thing. It's like we don't believe that some people are better than others and some people are going to be saved and some people are going to be sent to hell or anything like that. We believe that whatever it is that we're going to together. And sometimes that's classic theistic universalism, that we're all going to heaven and, you know, we die and then immediately we have glory and go to heaven, and that's great. And sometimes that's more the later 20th century universalism that says, you know, we're here on this earth, it's more, you know, this life-centered, we're here on this earth together, and whether we create heaven on earth or we create hell on earth, that is, you know, up to us and we'll be in that together. But then what that belief is, whether it's, I was mostly talking about heaven, but there's many humanists who just believe, you know, we die and that's it and we go back to the earth or there's no further consciousness. But the humanist UU, I would imagine, who believes that would believe that that happens to everyone, of course. I think UUs who believe in reincarnation, different afterlives, often a sense of going a slightly more mystical UU might believe that there's not necessarily this experience, this being that is right here, right now, experiencing things is not going to continue, but that my spirit, energy, body, will go back to the universe in sort of spiritual senses analogous to the way the body decomposes and goes back to the earth and that all the material cycles.
What he said. I think that was a very articulate answer. Thank you. I don't have anything to add.
Do you want one more?
Yeah? You want one more? Okay. Last question. Drum roll. Where's our drummer? Okay.
Oh, big one.
AJ.
Shirlene. Oh. Why do bad things happen to good people?
Oh, yeah. It's a title of a book, a very popular book by a rabbi whose son died of a cancerous disease. It's called Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Of course, there's a variety of beliefs around that. My own personal belief, you know, the question is, you know, there's a God question in that for some people. Why is God, am I being punished by God? There's a whole theological strand around that. My own personal belief is life happens, and I was just saying this to myself this morning. Life happens, and it is how we react to life happening that is in our control, or even in, I don't personally believe in a God that is punishing people. I believe that there's a life force of energy that we can move towards that provides us with what we need spiritually. And that's where for me, free will comes in. It's like I have choice to align my life towards those ways of being that help me with resiliency, help me when I feel like I have no resiliency, that sort of thing. But I believe that life happens just by a series of interactions that we don't have control over. So those bad things are not necessarily. And I think our own minds really, really want causality. Like I think it's just a part of our brain that really wants causality. It's not necessarily there, or only there in a portion of what's happening in life. So. AJ, what do you want to add?
I agree with that. What I would add is sort of the social or society dimension to that. So on the one hand, there's always, you know, the amoral caprices of nature. People are going to get sick. There will be hurricanes and accidents and various things. So there will always be bad things that happen to people regardless. But how we as a society, as communities, take care of one another and respond to that can have a huge impact on how bad that thing is, right? So if a tree falls on you, but you have a community that's there to help you and take care of you and, you know, appropriate science and medical doctors, maybe there's, you know, a quick healing process and you're okay. But if you're in a society that says, oh, tough luck, you got to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and that's all on you and there's no great health care or it's too expensive, then maybe you don't recover physically fully or something like that. So how our society responds to these things and supports one another has a huge impact on how bad things are. And some of the bad things that happen to us do have causality, and they are rooted in bad actors or bad systems, oppressive systems that, you know, retain wealth and power up at the top and lead to suffering towards others. There's sort of an inverse of the question, which is why do good things happen to bad people? And that's, you know, another sort of system question of, oh, okay, people have amassed power at the top and there's inequality. And so there's a lot that our society, I think, has to do to move towards a place where, you know, yes, sometimes bad things happen, but we're not actively harming each other all the time like it feels like we are sometime in our larger society. And when bad things do happen, that we support one another.
I'm going to also add that I try and deconstruct good and bad. So to really move myself from the polarity of this is just a bad thing and this is just a good thing. There's a wonderful Chinese story about that, you know, the horse, and you guys know that one, you know, the horse, and he lost his teeth, and, you know, it's a bad thing, we'll see. So in my own mind, it's helpful for me to deconstruct the polarities of good and bad. We're done? Yes, it's after 10. We're going to have some singing.